This month, demonstrations against the proposed new law to criminalise squatting boiled over, and 12 people were arrested.
Just go back! Go back!
Squatting may soon be a thing of the past.
It is wrong. It is wrong to go and live in somebody else's house. And I think the law is way behind the times in saying you should have to wait until you're asked to leave.
It doesn't make any sense to push this through anyway, especially in the middle of a housing crisis.
Housing Minister Grant Shapps and squatter activist Joe Blake, respectively. Squatting actually has a long tradition in Britain, dating back to the English Civil War, the diggers and levellers, and the whole idea of claiming land rights. Personally, my memories begin in the 1980s.
I'm outside a building here in Tottenham in northeast London, which is exactly as I remember it 30-odd years ago. Then it was a shabby, derelict and completely disused fire station. Now there's some people living in it. And I think we were the first people ever to live in it, because 30 years ago, my girlfriend and I squatted this place. Let's go inside. I mean, this is amazing. It's exactly as it was. And we were part of a movement, I think, at the time. Thousands and thousands of people, particularly across London and other cities in the UK, who were squatting empty buildings, almost all of them council-owned, that weren't being used, so I had no kind of moral concerns about that. And I'd like to chart the history of squatting, where it all began, and what the story of squatting really is. Because I'm an ex-squatter, and I need to go and check my car. I didn't have a car then, and there certainly weren't parking permits here either. It's all right at the moment. We contacted the council. We told them that we were living here and that we were prepared to pay rates. We got the electricity reconnected. We got the plumbing put on. We paid for all of that. We sanded the floors. We made it home, a very shabby home, no doubt. But we were starting out on a life and we needed somewhere to live. We couldn't afford market rents. We certainly wouldn't even have dreamt of being able to buy somewhere. It did, though, have a few quirky things. The bath was in the kitchen, and the toilet was an outside toilet. That wasn't unusual. It was fairly unusual, though, for the toilet to be out on the balcony, which this one was. And it used to freeze over in winter. I mean, this place was really cold in winter. Anyway, the funny thing about that is that the person I lived with here, my girlfriend, was Sade. I mean, originally, she was just my girlfriend Sade, art student from St Martin's, but then she started singing and wrote songs here like Your Love Is King and Smooth Operator and all that, all written up in this squat. And they became huge hits. And there was this extraordinary moment where she's going to go and do her first appearance on Top of the Pops. And the record company send a big limousine to pick her up. And it so happened that the toilet was frozen again. Only this time it was completely frozen and totally unusable. And there's a limousine waiting to take her. Maybe she's a bit nervous. She needs a wee. So she has to go to the toilet in a bucket. We literally didn't have a pot to piss in. And she was about to become a superstar. I mean, that for me was kind of, you know, it was not exactly typical of the times, but somehow it said an awful lot about what squat living meant back then.
Your love is king. Crown you with my heart. Your love is king.
In the 1980s, myself and Sade were fairly typical squatters. Students would be bohemians, I guess, seeking cheap digs in the city while we found our way in the world. To understand where squatting in its modern sense comes from, we have to go back a little earlier. Eileen Milton, then a young woman, now a sprightly 90-year-old, remembers wartime bombing raids in Bristol.
The Germans used to come over most nights and drop 6 bombs, and they were aiming for the smelting works. We were in our shelter, and you could count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, over the house, 2, right? And that's how they did it night after night. And the Molotov cocktails were floating down to give them light to see the different targets that they wanted were quite pretty.
Britain in 1946 was perhaps a surprisingly bleak place, really.
Historian David Kynaston, author of Austerity Britain.
Although we'd won the war, the British population soon discovered that actually it wasn't going to be a land of milk and honey. There was considerable rationing, all sorts of shortages of food and necessary goods, an acute housing crisis, and I think more broadly, a certain sense of social dislocation, often concerning the family. There was a very high divorce rate. There was also a very high crime rate in the immediate post-war period. These were difficult years.
Along with social upheaval, hundreds of thousands of houses had been destroyed by the Luftwaffe. The new Labour government was committed to rebuilding an exhausted and war-weary country. But in the meantime, thousands who had nowhere to live took it upon themselves to find somewhere. Eileen Milton discovered a place in a former POW camp.
I went up to this site, nobody there. It's an Italian prisoner of war camp. So I walked in and claimed one, put a bit neck curtain. And then we put the bedroom furniture up at the ut end and then divided it with the bedroom furniture and made a dining room this end and made it quite cosy.
Were there many people squatting at that time in Bristol?
Oh, yes, any other big sites. Ours eventually got full, and then we took it in turns, the ladies, to keep the ablutions clean, right? And a man who used to work for the council, he was in one of the huts, and we all agreed then to pay a nominal rent of 8 and 6, mainly to bring the electricity in from the main road up into the site. And it was turned on, I can't remember now, but it was one night or two nights before we left. So he gave me money back.
Fantastic. Some people would say it wasn't your property. What were you doing living there?
Well, that never entered my head. Yeah, in desperation. You've lived through 6 years of war. You know a few hardships.
Eileen and her family stayed in the camp, neck curtains and all, for a few months before moving into one of the first Bevan-built council houses in Bristol, where she still lives to this day. She was one of thousands of mainly working-class people all across Britain who took it upon themselves to take over barracks and camps in a forgotten episode of our social history. Another in need of a home was Beryl Todd. Now 86, she and her then husband, a returning desert rat, squatted for more than 3 years in the Abbots Lee area of Bristol. She remembers the locals gave her family a hard time.
They weren't very amenable to us. They called us squatters and they didn't really like us being there. My husband's children were at school and the kids would sometimes taunt them, telling that they were squatters. So I would say, well, you say to them, we are not squatters, we are tenants. I wouldn't go to the village shop, let's put it like that, because they didn't really like us. And they would say, they live in the squatters' camp.
This is perhaps the first sign of an idea which still persists today, that squatting goes against those quintessential British values of patience and waiting your turn. It was a form of queue jumping, a very un-British thing to do. But Bristol historian Eugene Byrne says most understood that these were extraordinary times.
The overwhelming majority of people are really quite sympathetic to the squatters because they're not doing any harm. In Bristol, they elect a sort of an umbrella organisation for all the squats in Bristol, and the chairman's biggest concern is the religious education of the children in the squats. There is something desperately respectable about this. I can think of very few movements that have involved squatting property that have been quite so decorous, well-mannered and polite.
But in London, away from the Nissen huts and neck curtains, events were taking on a more overtly political tone. The Communist Party, then a potent force, called for the mass squatting of private property to house the bombed-out homeless in the empty mansion flats of the rich. Here, the authorities responded very differently.
Until then, people had been squatting government property, empty military sites that were of no use to anyone otherwise. But now, the Communist Party are moving in on private property. And the reaction to this in the press is quite hysterical, because everybody understands that this is a significant raising of the stakes. The government is not going to stand for this for a moment. It comes down on these people like a ton of bricks. The leaders are arrested. People are evicted from these sites that they've moved into. But then most of them, you find, are actually quickly and very quietly rehoused.
Eugene Byrne. These early squatting movements highlighted a tension which still exists today between the collectivist notion of a right to somewhere to live and the deeply entrenched idea that an Englishman's home is his castle, but also between two conflicting concepts of fairness. Is it fair to leave property empty when some people haven't got a roof over their heads? And is it fair to just take over an empty property? As Britain was rebuilt, the parties battled to construct as much social housing as possible. This was housing for everybody, the doctor alongside his patients. Journalist Lindsay Hanley, author of Estates, An Intimate History of Council Housing, says they almost overdid it.
You know, particularly in the 60s and 70s, so much housing was built that eventually we actually ended up with a surplus. There was actually too much housing at the end of the 70s.
Too much housing? I mean, that's an extraordinary idea, unimaginable at the moment.
From the mid-1950s onwards, right up until the mid-70s, the two main parties would compete with each other on the basis of how many houses they would build. But in the late 60s, there was something like 400,000 to 450,000 new homes being built a year. And now it's 100,000 a year. It's an absolutely pitiful number by comparison. And also the new towns, the size of the new towns, for instance, Harlow and so on, and Cumbernauld, all these factors conspired together to produce essentially a net surplus of housing.
Now that seems almost unbelievable. But then so does the thought that large swathes of our cities, especially London, should be all but abandoned. But that was exactly what happened by the 1970s. This allowed the heyday of squatting. I remember it as a time of nearly deserted neighbourhoods, corrugated iron swathing crumbling buildings, inner city decay and neglect. I met up with Andy Beckett, author of When the Lights Went Out, Britain in the 1970s.
There were a million less people in London in the 70s to the number there are now, and it was a much tattier city. There was a lot of opportunity. A lot of these empty buildings were there. A lot of businesses had gone bust in the early 70s at the end of the Heath government. So it was a city of kind of tattiness and empty spaces and possibility. So quite depressing if you're an underconfident person, but if you're someone with a bit of gumption and a bit of youth, maybe a few more opportunities than there are now.
I mean, I looked at the figures myself. Between 1941 and 1981, inner London lost something like half its population. Extraordinary.
Absolutely. The centre of London was just somewhere where there weren't that many traditional opportunities. It seems odd to us now when it's full of tourists, it's full of, you know, bankers. It's a much more sort of smartened up city. But at the time, in the 70s, a lot of wealthy people didn't want to live in the middle of the city. They wanted to live further out. And a lot of industries wanted to be further out in greenfield sites, in big warehouse areas and industrial parks. So the centre of the city didn't seem to have much of a function, except perhaps for tourism. And at the time, people really thought this kind of Victorian sort of streetscape was just over. It didn't fit modern life anymore. People wanted more space. They wanted an American kind of space with, you know, driveway, double garage. The influence of California on how people in Britain wanted to live in the 70s was very, very strong. In places like Milton Keynes, which was being built in the 70s, the ideal that they were building there, this kind of spread-out Los Angeles-type city, that was the way city planning was still going in the 70s.
It was against this backdrop that a young Tony Sleep moved into what was to become the most notorious squat in Britain. It seems incredible, now that Notting Hill has become a byword for urban affluence, home of the Prime Minister indeed, to think that not so long ago it was largely deemed a slum. My family came from there, and we saw our house, along with many others, condemned. The locals were decamped into high-rise Stalinist stalagmites, and whole streets of crumbling houses were abandoned and left to rot.
It was a wasteland. Freston Road, the house has actually been empty for over 10 years.
Now a professional photographer, Tony Sleep squatted for 8 years in Frestonia, battling the Greater London Council to let him and many others stay. Living precariously in those crumbling terraces may not have been ideal, but it did provide a base for him and countless young creatives, artists and musicians like The Clash, who were also part of the Frestonia story. For Tony, back in Freston Road, things soon came to a head with the GLC.
We were faced with eviction, and after a couple of years of living with that, it seemed to be reaching some sort of crescendo. So declaring UDI seemed like a good wheeze at the time. It did work. It got the world's press down there. And all of a sudden, squatting was on the agenda.
When you say declaring UDI, yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, we seceded from the United Kingdom. We decided that since we didn't much like what the United Kingdom was wanting to do to us, we'd jolly well not be part of it anymore. So we decided to form our own little state, which we called the Independent Republic of Frestonia. We asked the United Nations to send a peacekeeping force, if necessary, to keep the GLC out, but we never got the tanks, unfortunately.
And apart from asking for Blue Beret UN troops to come and help you, what else did you do? You had passports and all sorts, didn't
you? Yeah, there were passports and stamps issued. People actually travelled on the passport stamps, amazingly, and the letters were delivered all over the world with Frestonian stamps on. We never understood how or why.
Shelley Assiter, another Frestonia veteran, still lives by Freston Road, a sign that in many ways they won. She now helps run the Bramley Housing Co-op, the homes that the council reluctantly built, complete with communal garden, when the Freston Road squats were eventually demolished. I asked her about the politics of Frestonia.
We were anarchists, yeah. I mean, over there, everything that we did was totally anarchic. But did we sit around and discuss politics and thought, you know, this is what we are and this is how we do things? Maybe some did. I definitely was not a part of any of that. So we had people who came here from the street who were homeless. We had people who were very well educated in private schools who came out of some social conscience. We just were really a mishmash of everything. We were artists. We were anarchic. I mean, you know, who would declare themselves an independent state?
She showed me some of the correspondence from the 1970s.
This is the Declaration of Independence.
It says the Free Independent Republic of Frestonia, application to the United Nations, to the Secretary General of the United Nations in New York. And so this was actually, I mean, it looks very officially drawn
up,
doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. Yeah, it was. The whole thing was properly done. We never got any response from them, obviously. But
It says, October 30th, 1977, we, the Free Independent Republic of Frestonia, herewith apply for full membership of the United Nations with autonomous nation status. You must have had, obviously you had a smile on your face.
Oh, we had a lot of fun.
I got another letter here from Horace Cutler, who was the leader of the GLC at the time. And he says, I have the copy you sent me of your letter to Sir Geoffrey Howe. All I can say is, were you not to exist, it would be necessary to invent you.
But amid the fun and games of playing politics, life was very tough. Tony Sleep.
It was a very uncomfortable way to live. You don't know when you're going to be evicted. You don't know when you're going to be homeless. I was there for 8 years and I never knew from 1 week to the next what would be happening. There was constant social stress as well. I mean, you know, it's on all levels. It's personal, individual. The politics of the time was very volatile. It was quite a violent era. We had lots of problems with most of the outsiders coming into the area looking for trouble or wanting to commit crimes. I got so fed up with people trying to kick the door in at 3 o'clock in the morning for criminal reasons that I used to keep a row of 30 bricks by the window so that I could lean out at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, please go away.
Did that happen?
It happened many times. I never actually threw bricks at anyone, but I did occasionally lean out of the window and wave them. It's not a nice way to live.
But I do know that a lot of the locals, the sort of working class locals, didn't like you lot much. So why are all these hippies living in our old houses, they'd say?
It's a fair point, isn't it? I mean, the people in Edward Woods had been, some of them at least, have been kicked out of the houses that we ended up living in. And they got stuck in the nice new modernist high-rise creations of the 1960s, looking down on their old houses and watching them rot. And of course they wanted homes with gardens, the same as everybody else did, for the most part. So when we turned up and took over these derelict houses, they were looking at us and thinking, well, that's just not fair. I can understand that they feel they got a short straw.
There was a fair bit of hostility.
Shelley Assiter.
We were the dirty squatters. Although there were people here who were not, you know, who lived very decently and kept their homes as much as they could, really clean and tidy and had jobs and...
But what about the local gypsy community? Because that's another aspect of this area. There's always been a traveller and a gypsy community. Were you kind of kindred spirits?
No. We, as far as they were concerned, we were the bottom of the heap. We were lower than them, and they really terrorised us.
Perhaps so. There was more of a class thing going on. You say you were bottom of the heap, but I remember lots of locals thought of you, actually, they're all middle class. That was what they were most annoyed about.
That's true. But we were bottom of the heap because we were squatters.
Why can't we roll? This open country.
There were those who occupied buildings that they didn't rent or own, who refused to call themselves squatters. And they didn't fit the stereotype of white middle class hippies. George James was part of a Rastafarian community at St Agnes Place in South London. He lived there for more than 30 years, Britain's longest-running squat, before finally being evicted by riot police in 2005. Famous visitors included the great Bob Marley.
To us, it was a community where we had a common ideal, which is sustainable well-being. And that's the premise on which we occupied spaces in St Agnes Place.
You wouldn't have thought of yourselves as squatters, then? You wouldn't have used that term?
We wouldn't, but the wider community would make out that we are squatting or taking liberties of other people's property.
But Marley came down, didn't he?
That's right. The community was a sort of a spiritual centre. But we had cultural activities all the time, including drums and music and stuff like that. And obviously he was a musician of mega, mega, mega talent. And we enjoyed his visits very much.
What would you say, George, to people who said, yeah, but you never paid rent, you never paid rates, you were breaking the law?
We couldn't argue on the legality of our occupation. We had to pay for electrics, we had to pay for gas. It wasn't free. It didn't look to us that we was without expenses. We refurbished those houses from our own pockets.
I asked former Frestonian Tony Sleep, did he feel bad about breaking the law?
Personally, yes, I did. It feels very naughty to take over property that, where nobody's looking after it and seems to care about it, and it's been left empty for 10 years. It feels disobedient and wrong in some way. I would admit that. But it's funny how you get over that, if you need to. People imagine all sorts of things about squatting, that it's teams of people with crowbars looking for houses where the lights are not on. It really wasn't like that in Frestonia, anyway. It was houses that had no windows, quite often no doors, no electricity, no water, no plumbing, holes in the roofs, and it didn't really feel like you were depriving anyone of anything.
The law has always been there to deal with squatting, but back in the 70s, perhaps because property was not as valuable as now, the police seemed quite relaxed about it. Back then, Ken German was a young copper charged with dealing with squatters up in the Camden area of London.
Squatters were always a problem, or seen to be a problem. Whether they were my problem or not, that's not the case. I think people used to complain about them a lot, but there was a diverse, eclectic bunch they were. But usually you left them alone until someone complained. There were some very, very well-educated people. I remember going in there and with a few friends. Friends were police officers, and it was rather, oi, come here, you know, what are you doing here? And I think, you know, these people would turn around and say, excuse me, are you talking to me? And they used to say, well, yes, I am, yes. Well, actually, I live here, and I'm perfectly legal do so. If you want to do something, I suggest you get a warrant. And we used to look at each other and blink and think, oh, this chap is educated, you know, leave him alone, move on to next door, you know, something like that. Some of them I actually enjoyed. I must admit, even on duty, I went to a few parties there. And yes, plenty of good memories.
So you were bopping about in squats in your uniform?
You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Times, though, have changed. Houses are no longer just somewhere to live. Property prices have soared. Attitudes have hardened. The recent spate of squatting cases, splashed all over our newspapers, seem to suggest that the law is not working. The big difference to the 1970s is that these involve private homes, which are squatted while the owners are away. One of those who found their home occupied was Dr. Oliver Cockerell. He told Radio 4 that the law offered him little protection.
I've been homeless for 3 weeks, and they're afraid they haven't gone. They offered to move out the day they moved in when I first spoke to them, but they haven't gone. And surely a house is someone's property. And if we're saying that in this country that anyone can occupy someone else's house because they have a greater need, then that is just a charter for anarchy.
Cases like this are rare and very unlike the vast majority of squatters that we came across while researching this programme. The press and public are rightly outraged by the immorality of squatters taking over other people's homes. But how many times does this actually happen? We asked the Housing Minister, Grant Shapps.
It's impossible to be absolute about this because, of course, sometimes people will leave when they're asked to. Other times, of course, it goes to court. And when it does, the misery contained in that can be enormous. I mean, it's a bit like arguing that, you know, there's not that much murder around, you know, so it shouldn't be illegal. Of course it should be illegal, and it should be illegal on the basic principle that it is wrong. It is wrong to go and live in somebody else's house. And I think the law is way behind the times in saying you should have to wait until you're asked to leave. And actually, oftentimes that means people have to go to court, and oftentimes they end up having to pay the bills.
Yeah, but how many times?
Destruction that's been done in the meantime. Well, it may not be loads and loads of times, but there aren't loads and loads of murders, but we still make sure that murder is illegal.
As an ex-squatter myself, I'm not sure it really equates to murder, but I certainly accept that some squatters can be a real nuisance, a blight on people's lives. I spoke to one man who'd prefer to remain anonymous, who discovered this when living next door to squatters. After months of antisocial behaviour, the final straw came at a party.
Early in the morning, it's probably about 4 or 5 in the morning, they were smashing their own walls in. And then it quietened down the following day. They actually left the flat, and it wasn't so bad for a few more weeks. But it was always a short-term thing. They'll break back into the house again, and then it would just start all over again. I walked back into the house once they moved out. There were some people building, doing some work in the house, so we asked if we could have a look inside the house. It was like a sea of beer bottles. You could hardly walk in the house without tripping over a beer bottle. It was unbelievable, the mess that they were living in. It's just filthy, just disgusting.
So does the law actually need changing? At present in Scotland, it's a criminal offence to squat vacant residential property. In England and Wales, it's a civil issue. The government's new bill wants to change the law in England and Wales to make it a crime, punishable by fines of up to £5,000 or a year in prison. Chris Shaw, a landlord in Leeds, is chairman of the Residential Landlords Association. He says that for his members, squatting is a sporadic problem. In 23 years, he's only actually had one bad experience, but was shocked that the police seemed unable to help him.
I went straight round to the police station and said, I've got this chap who's declaring himself as a squatter and is refusing to leave the property. So the police said, oh, well, come and have a look. And they came round and it had not forced entry. So they said, well, he's not forced entry, there's nothing we can do, which absolutely staggered me. And I said, well, he's occupying illegally, as far as I'm concerned. I've not invited him to stay. He's said he's not going to pay any rent. He just wants to occupy the property. Surely there's something you can do about that. And at that point, they said, well, no, it's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter, and therefore the police cannot be involved in it and cannot resolve it, and you must go to your lawyer. I was absolutely flabbergasted at their response. And I think I said to a police officer, if you go home tonight and someone sat in your living room watching your TV and you've forgotten to lock the door, let's say, this morning, how would you feel?
The main problem with the law isn't necessarily the law itself.
Barrister David Cowan is Professor of Law at Bristol University and specialises in housing issues.
The main problem is that the police do not seem to understand the basic law. And the basic law isn't really that complicated. It will be fairly obvious when somebody is squatting, and it will be fairly obvious that somebody is a displaced residential occupier, that is to say, they were occupying the property immediately before the squatters entered. And indeed, somebody who's an intended residential occupier has to provide a statement to that effect. These offences are not entirely different from a simple case of dealing with theft.
The Association of Police Officers and the Metropolitan Police Service declined our request to be interviewed. But Housing Minister Grant Shapps acknowledged there are problems in this area.
Well, I've no doubt there are instances where the police perhaps don't act as quickly as they could do, but actually I think the basis of the current law is insufficient. Nobody should be in any doubt. When you trespass somebody else's home and you decide to go and live in it, that's when the criminal offence should take place.
But there will be more people homeless and there will be people in prison.
No, I don't accept
for
that for
homeless.
A moment. No, I don't accept either of those premises. The idea that because you don't provide the escape route of taking over somebody's house and what will be illegally living in it, and instead force local authorities to live up to their responsibilities to accept their homelessness duty, which is defined in law, and provide a decent roof over that person's head, the idea is that is somehow going to lead to more people in prison or what have you, is nonsense.
But an estimated 20,000 current squatters and many others are not so sure. During the consultation period for the bill, the Law Society, the Criminal Bar Association, the Magistrates Association and major homeless charities all came out against the idea of new legislation. Perhaps more predictably, people living in current squats, like one I visited by Heathrow Airport, are worried.
This land was a horrible site, really, when we got here.
Heathrow Grow is an eco-squat, originally established to fight the third runway, but now home to a group of young activists who've converted once toxic land into a ramshackle but surprisingly comfortable home, stroke farm, stroke commune. Full of youthful idealism, but now also a certain cynicism about the way they believe this bill is being rushed through, tacked onto the back of another piece of legislation. Joe showed me round.
I've got to describe what we're in. It's kind of like a house, only it's clearly in what used to be a greenhouse. It's, I don't know, plastic above
bubble
us.
Bubble wrap,
is that?
That's to keep us warm in the winter, yeah.
OK, and there's a piano.
That was donated from a local resident called Lynn, who lives around the corner. She just turned up with it one day.
And computers.
We have solar panels, so we're all sustainable at the moment. All our electricity is run off-grid, which means we don't have to rely on fossil fuels and mains electricity.
Now, I guess the criticism of many people would be, you don't have to do this. You could find somewhere better to live, couldn't you? Or somewhere legal to live.
The key point is that there's 700,000 empty properties and empty bits of land. This borough of Hillingdon has so many sites like this not being used.
But you're not paying for it. It's someone else's land, isn't it?
By law, but it's not being used. It's pretty much abandoned. The owners of this land were actually evicted off this site by the council before we came and took it because they were contaminating what was agricultural land.
Joe thinks the government are ignoring the findings of their own consultation on the proposed new law to criminalise squatting.
Only 10 people responded saying they had been victims of squatting. And then 2,126 people replied saying they don't want to see any action on squatting.
So why are they so insistent on this? Why are they pushing it through?
It doesn't make any sense to push this through anyway, especially in the middle of a housing crisis. The only reason we can see them pushing it through is it will protect property speculators and unscrupulous landlords that, you know, are simply keeping properties empty to up their profits.
And I guess as well, too, because there are a lot of people out there who think you're scum.
That's what they're pushing in the media, by making it seem like squatters are squatting everyone's home everywhere. This isn't true. Already strong legislation exists to prevent this from happening.
Nobody denies that we are currently in a housing crisis, and it's also true that we have an estimated 700,000 empty properties. And squatting has always occurred when those two factors coincide. But few believe that squatting is the real answer. Former Frestonian Tony Sleep.
Nobody does it expecting to still be doing it in 10 years' time, or even 3 weeks' time very often. It's just a, for now, emergency solution. You can't defer the problem of not having anywhere to live. If you need somewhere to live and you haven't got anywhere to live and you haven't got any money, what are you going to do? You're going to go to a hostel, perhaps. You're going to go on the streets, perhaps. A lot of people who ended up in Frestonia came from the streets and ended up on the streets later. It was a real mixture of reasons why people ended up in that particular circumstance, and I know for a fact it's exactly the same now.
But squatting isn't the same now as it was even when I did it 30 years ago. Then there were many council-owned properties left empty, and squatters brought them back to life. I certainly can't support the idea of taking somebody else's home, and I'd be appalled if it happened to me. But when I meet people like Joe at Heathrow Grow, well, I know we have to respect people who want to live differently. But above all, we have to find a way to make sure that everybody has a roof over their heads. When I went back to the old fire station in Tottenham, where I squatted, I was rather proud that a building which had once sat empty for years is still providing just that.